hilft es dann. Again, some questions from previous meetings. Some remaining questions on Oxford in the 20s and the 30s. Philosophy in Oxford, when you came to Oxford, and then in the 30s, when you were a fellow of Salt, until the war, let's say. How was it regarded, I mean, in the university, among students, among faculty, students who went to read philosophers? What kind of image philosophy did they have? I mean, was it the queen of disciplines? Was it... There was no hierarchy? What?
No, there was a hierarchy. I'll tell you, Rosberg philosophy as such, it was a very highly regarded subject. The best dish which Oxford offered in its double dot was grapes, literary humanities. It isn't so much now. All kinds of things have happened, but in the 20s and 30s, this goes back to the 19th century. Certainly goes back to Baylor in the 80s and before. Was a combination, this very unique Oxford combined dish of ancient history and philosophy. Originally, of course, it was the classical world, ancient philosophy, ancient history. Then when modern philosophy thrust its way through, it became detached from Plato and Aristotle, as it remained. Plato and Aristotle were there. That was regarded as the most distinguished of all Oxford non-scientific degrees. That was it. And philosophy was intrinsic. Moreover, there was PPE already, since 19, I don't know, fairly early 20s. Philosophy was part of both. It was the only subject which was part of both. And although greats dominated PPE, the standard was higher. Only people who could read Greek could do it. Only ancient historians. Nevertheless, so philosophy was very highly regarded. It certainly was, so to speak, fashionable. And next to philosophy was probably history. And after that, everything else was far less important in the humanities. Classical as such was the first part of grades. You didn't need to do it, I didn't. But in theory, 5 terms of classics, 7 terms of so-called literary humanities, first part, second part. You could skip the first part by doing a past examination, which I did, for example. But most people didn't. Because most people, like, I don't know how, but hard did. But most people from public schools did both. So classics was intrinsic. Classics was high, philosophy was high, ancient history was part of the classics. That was a top subject. Then came history. Then the rest. Well, the language is English. God knows what else was for humanists to do.
English literature?
Yes, English, I say. English, modern languages.
Modern languages?
Part of which great many women did. And just think what else was to do. I mean, it was PPE, not as good as greats. But still not bad, what?
Economy?
No. That's part of PPE. You couldn't do it as such. You couldn't do politics or economics or as such. Only in combination with philosophy. Tripart that subject. After that, what could you do in finals? You could do geography, I suppose.
Yes.
But it was not a full-fledged subject. Honors geography was a little remote, agriculture. That sort of thing. Nobody with any distinction or ability did that. If you did it, because you weren't very clever and you wanted to get a degree.
Theology?
Theology, yes. not highly regarded, but it existed. But intellectually, it was already in the 20s of no standard.
Archaeology was also...
you could do Oriental languages. That is real. That is genuine. Small subject, but genuine.
Now, students of in grades or in philosophy, the 12th graduation...
Law! I forgot. That's an enormous school. Law. Never regarded as intellectually particularly good. Better now than it was.
The best lawyers didn't study law.
Exactly.
Now, the students of philosophy... distinguished themselves, that were good students. What did the teachers expect from you, and you as a teacher, when you became a teacher in the service, to understand well philosophy, or to philosophize?
Oh, to both. Both. Nobody was content with a man who expounded philosophy very well, but had no views of his own. No position. Nothing he wanted to defend or develop. That didn't exist. If it existed, it was the tail end. All philosophers had a position of some kind. They all belonged to philosophical societies. They all argued with each other. You see, it was an active Socratic subject. It was not learning.
That's my feeling.
It was not learning. The German philosopher came here, Cassira, was terribly shocked. Terribly shocked. All this argument. When he came here, it's quite amusing. I got him here. I was responsible for inviting him, to get him invited to All Souls. Well, he was the most learned philosopher in Germany, probably. Pupil of Hermann Cohen. Part of the Warburg Institute, and he knew a very great deal. He was the greatest living authority on Kant. As he didn't talk English, we organized a seminar for him in German with Dons, who understood German. It was an absolute galaxy. Everybody came who was any good. Not the older ones, but Price, Ryle, they were the famous philosophers of the time. They're called Foster, got a degree in Germany, Frédéric, Austin, let me see, who else came, Grossman, all people, because he spoke German.
Yeah.
Exactly. People who didn't know any German couldn't come. One or two others. And even in my rooms, here in All Souls. And the seminar was on Leibniz's Theodicee, as he called it, Theodicee, because he'd written a book on that in 1910. So we thought he might still remember, he might explain it to us. Well, people read it in Latin, which was written. English translation existed, of course. And then questions were asked. Some people said, put questions like, do you think what he says here is consistent with what he says in some other work? That he didn't like. If you asked such a question as, do you think what he says is true? That struck him as absolutely irrelevant. It's as if you would ask whether what Racine said was true. That's not how we did it. The purpose of doing Leibniz is to explain what his relation was to Spinoza, to Descartes, and ultimately to Kant. All streams led to Kant. And he was very learned, prodigiously learned. And he explained exactly what the text meant and how it was connected with Jansenism, how it was connected with Greek philosophy, etc. But the question of truth was somehow not something he could, when he was sure that I don't know, disturbed him. He was very polite. So what he would say is, that is a very good question. It might well have puzzled Leibniz himself. So you got top marks for that. But no answer came. He was very unhappy and left for Sweden. Very highly regarded in Göteborg. Wrote two works in Swedish philosophy, which is a very, very remote subject, as you can imagine. And finally ended up in Yale, where he was worshipped. So, great philosopher. Tremendous regard for him. He was a learned man. His books, I'm not a great admirer of his, but he was certainly a distinguished philosopher.
Well, is the tradition still kept?
Absolutely. Mind you, what they're accused of now is becoming narrower and narrower and more specialized. But the specialization is to do with what they believe, with analysis, and not learning. Sheer philosophical learning, knowing the history of philosophy, is quite respected, but is not required.
No.
Required less than I would think is actually necessary. Myself, I'm rather in favor of it. Knowing the history of philosophy. It's not needed.
Your experience, so 50 years or so.
More than that.
At least...
soon 60.
It'll
soon be 60 years.
When you have to judge a young student, the age of 15, 19, 20, at least you can judge his solidity in learning in a quite safe way.
Yeah.
When it comes to the history of philosophy and
what Descartes' ideas.
Now, isn't the danger to judge a student, whether he can think philosophically.
That is the sole purpose of the entire discipline in Oxford. Knowledge is not enough. Nobody can get a first class in either grades or modern grades by knowing what these people say, by just expounding.
Now, and those who got first class,
Or second class,
who pursued academic career, usually...
In philosophy.
Usually, the promise was fulfilled,
it's too general a question. Well, let me see. Who were they in my time?
I'm not thinking about the shining lights.
The ordinary tutors. Yes. No, there are plenty of mediocrities. Plenty of mediocrities.
Who might have been very brilliant for a year or two.
They were not necessarily brilliant. Brilliant, you didn't need brilliance.
I know.
Just certain intellectual solidity, capacity for understanding arguments, for defending positions, a little bit the combination of capacity for drafting, which is what solicitors have, and capacity for arguing, which was barristers have. The combination of these two qualities was probably sufficient. You could be a dull philosopher, perfectly well, and still get a fellowship, provided you had some degree of intellectual power. The whole purpose was to develop intellectual power, not to impart knowledge. Analytic power and power of argument, I'll tell you a story which Macmillan tells. Quite amusing. There was a philosopher in Balliol when he was young. This man was called J.A. Smith, who afterwards became not very distinguished professor of philosophy here. He was a tutor in Balliol. He gave lectures. He would begin as follows, according to Macmillan, who went to them. Did philosophy probably did. Gentlemen, when you let it in. Doubtless, some of you will pursue interesting careers. Some of you will manage great landed estates. Some of you will enter His Majesty's forces. Some of you will take the cloth into the church. Some of you will go to the bar. That's how people distinguish one those days. Some of you will enter the civil service and the diplomatic service. I can assure you that nothing in these lectures will be of the slightest use to you in any of these callings. But if you persist with my course and remain to the end, there is one thing I can promise you, that you will derive. You will always know when a man is talking rot. That's Macmillan's story. It's quite amusing. That was the purpose. Capacity for critical approaches. For some kind of destruction, what might be called naive traditionalism. Or believing what your nurse told you. Everything that Mrs. Thatcher is against.
Now, what happened, and I think it happened partly in your early days.
Mind you, it didn't have that effect. But all of them, my colleagues, were always trying to upset young men and make them think, make them give up ideas they had. Oh. They all emerged dogmatists, exactly the opposite. But it did not have that effect. No. They all emerged absolutely uncritical, probably. They enjoyed it. The number of people who enjoyed doing philosophy in principle is very small. And therefore the number of people who did it was too great. It was not a proper discipline for most people. It didn't really suit them. And some of them were tormented by doing a subject which they did not begin to understand from beginning to end. That happened quite often. Quite able people. My still living colleague Hicks got a Nobel Prize in economics, a famous economist. He did grades in Babel. Oh no, maybe PVE. He did social studies. And he got a second. And he got a second because of philosophy. He never recovered from it. He took up economics, naturally, after that. Always tried to philosophize a bit. He never liked it. He regarded it self-consciously as an enemy subject. Quite a lot of people do that.
Now, you were in a period...
People who are no good at philosophy and are made to do it become persecuted about it. Yes, what?
What happens when there is a new wave, let's say somebody who was attracted to logical positivism or to the Vienna School and is young, wants to pave his way in the university, and the majority of the fellows in philosophy are in a different school. It can happen.
Oh yes. Happen quite often.
So, when schools come here?
If there is a collision, if the tutor is any good, he realizes that there is something too difficult here, and he tries to send the man to some other tutor who is more sympathetic. That can happen.
It can happen. But,
yes.
But
not too often.
Not
often. Usually, the pupils are persuaded by the philosophers of that point of view. We have to have a great deal of force of character to resist. A tutor holds entirely different views. But on the whole, the trouble with Oxford philosophy, in the 30s, there was a great variety of views. They argued with each other, but they were on quite good terms. I mean, someone like Collingwood her view is very different from someone like Ryle. So you could pick and choose. But you could always go to all lectures. If you went to lectures and were influenced by the lecturer, your tutor was impressed. None of the teachers of philosophy were so fanatical as to reject. In my time, perhaps one or two. Very few said, it's all nonsense what you were saying. And there could be, I can see how you might think this could happen. He didn't. The trouble was different, that towards the end of the 30s, most progressive philosophers began to think the same things as they do now. Now there is an orthodoxy of a kind of linguistic, analytical kind. It's rather difficult to be an Oxford philosopher and not believe any of this. There are a few. They can differ. They can differ as much as they like. But in what's called the straight philosophy, they're all disciples of Russell, Moore, Bartier of analytic philosophy, of formal logic, the rest of it. They just are. A lot. Not only in Oxford, Cambridge, Oxford, London, everywhere.
Now,
there are no Hegelian philosophers of any reputation.
And in your days?
There were.
Did Collingwood start as an academic?
Before the First World War, yes. More or less. Idealist, yes. There was Professor Joachim. Joachim was a certain Hegelian. There was Muir, became warden of Merton after the war, wrote books about Hegel. There was a man called Walsh, who never became a Don here. He became one and came back and thought, maybe he did teach in Merton. No, he did teach. He was a Hegelian.
Now, was the Locke Prize the peak of...
Yes.
And it's every year?
Every year.
Now, is this a good examination? I mean, if you can, if you observe...
No, you've touched a very good thin nerve.
Why?
I got half the Locke Prize. The other half was got by a man called Button. I got the Locke.
You said half the...
Because somebody else got the other half. Two people got the prize. Equal. Next year, the two philosophers were Adria and John Austin, who were certainly the ablest philosophers we had. Neither got it. Because the professors could not bring themselves to think that what these people wrote was any good. There was straight prejudice and blindness. That happened.
It happened.
Yep.
But it's not the order of the day. I mean, usually... No. What happened to you?
I was more conventional, probably. But the point is that they did it. And that was a scandal. There was a man called Plamenauz afterwards.
Yes.
Who was professor after me.
Exactly.
He was failed in his doctorate. For the only book, which was any good book, which was any good on that subject, for years, it was published. He got into this college, All Souls, on the strength of this book, because we had a new kind of fellowship called thesis, where you could get in on something written, not an examination. And he was elected on that. And he was failed by sheer prejudice by the examiners. That can happen.
Plamenauz was more of historian of ideas.
No,
he was not
a philosopher.
He was
a political thinker.
Yeah.
He was not a straight philosopher. The book wasn't straight philosophy. But the people who... The first book, it was called something like Freedom, Consent, and Political Obligation, written in... which he wrote in 1936, before the war, as a graduate student. For a doctorate. It was a L'Oreal. It was a very good book. And it was failed by Charles Morris, who was an idealist from Balliol, went in with the other man was. But it was a scandal again. That could happen.
But as a rule, everyone who got the Bloch Prize became a fellow?
No, certainly not. My colleague John Hilton became an archaeologist and then went straight to the intelligence service. Still alive, perfectly good spy for the last 50 years. Got John Locke. I have no idea who got it off.
But the majority could be good philosophers.
Oh, yes. We didn't need to get it, to get a fellowship.
Now, Eddie was another doctor. There is another. Does it still exist?
Yes.
Is there any another topic?
What?
The essay you write.
It's not an essay. It's an exam.
It is?
Examination.
Is it examination?
Yes.
Oh, no.
It's not an essay.
You have to reply to two questions.
Three papers.
Three papers.
At least. It used to be. Straight exam.
And yet you can demonstrate originality or...
Oh, yes. Certainly. You can always demonstrate originality. There is papers. No thesis would have... Now it may have changed. I can't tell you what happened after the war. And then in my time. But there is a thing called the T.H. Green Moral Philosophy Prize. That's done on an essay. That's also worth having.
Now, did you go to the Aristotelian Society and
the... As a don, certainly. Certainly.
But you could go as a student too, or...
What?
As a student.
No, you couldn't. It's not for students. It's for different professionals. Not professionals, it's for...
A research fellow can go.
People in the public. You know, some private philosophers could go. It wasn't confined to academics, but in effect it is.
Now, from what I see from several books I read, not now, academic life for you in those societies was not less important than the daily university life.
What is the difference? What distinction are you thinking of?
I thought that probably was my mistake, that even when you were a student during your last days of studentship, you also you personally and others, you were active in societies. An active academic life.
Certainly. I mean, the philosophy was by the end, was probably what you took most interest in. But you went about other societies, debating societies,
that it implied submitting papers and...
Outside philosophy, you mean? Oh, yes. You read papers. There is an undergraduate philosophical society called the Joint Society. If you want to shine, that's where you shone. Certainly. Dons came to it. And they did, that is part of the way to become a philosopher. They noticed talent.
So that's the Joint Society?
Yes. That's an undergraduate society, which dons are allowed to come to. That is a philosophical society, only for dons.
And that was Aristotelian?
Aristotelian was in London. That was not Oxford. Same side is a national society.
Yes, I know. Uh-huh. So, and did you go frequently to the Joint Society?
Oh, certainly. I was a president of it in the end. Of course. Oh, absolutely. At least when I became really seriously interested, I probably went to every meeting that I could. Don't think it met every week. May have done.
That's what I have in mind, that was not less important than your duties at the university.
Oh, what duties do I have?
As a student?
What?
I think practice to your future.
Yes, but the same thing. Still on philosophy. But also ancient history, of course. And afterwards economics and politics, which I never really taught. Oh no, but I mean, you mustn't distinguish in interest in societies and what you did technically for your tutor. It overlapped. Your tutor would go to the same society, he would talk to you afterwards. But what you heard was all part of the same life. Very, very active philosophical life was in Oxford in my day. And I think there still is.
Yes, I can assure you.
And there still is.
I observe the students.
There still is, yes.
Now it's mainly among the PhD students, the D field.
Yes, but I've got B field, not D field. B field.
And there is a D field too.
Yes, but it's of no interest. The B field was invented after the war.
Yes, but I mean,
it counts the standard as that of a D field. There is a D field, that means you write a thesis.
Yes.
In the B field, you write a very short thesis and papers. But the B field is where you gather in seminars. That's where they get to know each other. That's where they argue. D field, you write a little room by yourself.
I want to tell you that I'm impressed by the new phenomena that the D field students are now getting to know each other and very active in society.
In philosophy? D-field, could be. It used to be field.
They have meetings and they go and...
Dons appear on the strings of B-field. They never needed a D. Never. In the old days, they didn't need anything. Just the first in schools, examination schools. But now you have to do B-field, it takes 2 years. D-field, well, maybe, I wonder why. Because they probably want to get dropped in America. But D-field counts.
The D field.
Yes.
But D field now counts in England,
right? I don't think so. If not philosophy, other universities maybe. No. Philosophy B field is enough. Everywhere. Look, remember, there are no first class philosophers outside Oxford, Cambridge, London. It's a very sad thing. Not really. There are competent philosophers. But the leading philosophers are accumulated here. Cambridge is no longer what it was. Oxford is no longer what it was. But it's still the leading philosopher university. Still.
And lately it is attracting many students from all over the world.
Not as many as it used to.
Really?
Nothing like. The glorious period was immediately after the war. When Austin dominated the scene, people came from all over the world. Then called Oxford philosophy. That's what it was called. For about 6-7 years, it was simply terrific. It had a reputation in the entire English-speaking world, and it was Austin who made it. When he died, it melted. I don't think there was anybody in Jerusalem, for example, who was here at that time.
No, I don't.
No, nobody.
It took time for Israeli philosophers to come to England.
Well, but Israel was ruined philosophically from the beginning.
I was going to ask you, you were on the one hand active in the Friends of Hebrew University and then the Board of Governors. Did they try to consult you, to drag you into the problems of the Fountains of Philosophy in Jerusalem?
No, never. I read papers in Jerusalem.
Yes.
And I mean, that happened 2 or 3 times. But no. They said not. Well, look, let's remember. The man who created the philosophy department was Bergmann. He was an old-fashioned German philosopher of the same kind of formation as Cassira. He was a pupil of Brentano in Prague. He was very learned and very nice. and know that for very saintly. He's your teacher, and he knew an awful lot, I'm sure, and he was a very lucid, probably, and careful expounder, and probably knew Kant and Hegel backwards. All that's true. But he had no... He had,
that was his name.
In what way?
He was clear. He was clear and simple. Like, unlike Rothstein.
No, but I mean, Brentano was clear and simple.
And he always tried to respect
Brentano. Brentano was clear and simple.
And he's a real pupil of him.
I know he was.
And from this point of view, he was unlike all the...
He was the only Jewish... He was the only Jewish pupil of Brentano was not converted to Christianity. The rest were. Karl Kraus was a man, somebody else. They all became converted. Berg was already Zionist when he came to the Karl University. Anyway, I'm sure he was all right, but I don't think he believed in argument much. He believed in Bekiut. He believed in learning. Learning. You just had to know what the great men thought. Then came Leon Roth, who did quite a good job of translating the classics. And he was a perfectly competent Oxford philosopher of his time. He came in Manchester or Liverpool or somewhere.
I thought he was from
Cambridge. No, he was here. No. Leon Roth was Exeter. And I don't know who his teacher was there. But he was an Oxford philosopher of the early 20s. He wrote a good book on Descartes and Spinoza. He could argue. But broadly, he too really believed in exposition. You see? And there's a very good parody of him in a French novel called Oxford and Margaret by a young Frenchman here who is at Exeter called, wait a minute, his father is a famous publisher. Publishing house still exists. Oxford, Hey Margaret, it is called. Translated Oxford Margaret. All about love affairs in Oxford. And it's a very amusing little description of Oxford in his day. Fayard, his name was. Well, he was the son of the original founder. Probably still alive, I don't know. He would be 80 at least. He has a character who is, in fact, Leon Roth. And somebody argues, says something philosophically, and Leon Roth says to him, Descartes thought this, and Spinoza thought that, and you deny it, do you? You think the opposite. I must say, yes. Yes. Leibniz did not think that. He was very much like a Talmudist, Kakatuf, as is written. Classical philosophy expounded. And these people generated Rothenstein.
Not
Bergman. Only Bergman. Only Bergman, I see. Perfectly. Roth was a perfectly competent provincial philosopher of his day. You could learn a great deal from him.
Now, the Israeli student, he was of real importance because, you know, students in those days came. These rather unclear ideas.
Very he was a very perfectly good teacher. Perfectly good teacher, to be clear.
And he brought the real good Oxford tradition and forced them to think.
No, I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did.
I mean, from this point of view, he was superb. Personally, he was not popular.
No, I know, but I knew him very well.
Bakker thought that he was a best teacher.
Yeah, probably was. Look. He was a perfectly well-trained. He was a well-trained, learned, serious, honest man. He was a good schoolmaster, really. He was a schoolmaster. But he was a first-class schoolmaster. First-class schoolmaster.
But, I mean, on the whole, his balance...
He was a fellow of the British Academy. He became one. People thought it was, people like Ryle were very extremely indignant that he did, thought nothing of him, and he became very excited about Camus after the war. Camus as a moral philosopher, which at least was original. Well, there he is. Oh no, it was very, quite all right, it meant something. Oh, he said, I respect him for it.
This Did he tell you why he left Israel? Did he discuss the whole problem?
The matter.
No, it's outside. No. It's a car outside.
Did he what?
When he left Israel.
No.
Because you see, it was quite. It was a
political. It must be political in some way.
Of course, yes. Well, he got disappointed. He just think of it.
But what is wrong with it? Nationalism?
Nationalism?
He was a Hadamist.
He was pure Zionist, and the dream was not implemented the way it
was. But what was wrong? Not enough ideology.
Not enough ideology, ethicism. I never discussed it with him. I was a
lawyer. Too political, I see. I think I must have talked to him about that. I think I saw him in an angry way. He did denounce Israel to me. He did.
Then he was disappointed from the way life in England went on. You see, the point was...
Of course. Well, nothing happened to me.
He bore in mind...
He was not taken up. He was not taken up. Nobody paid the faintest attention to him as a philosopher. He may have taught somewhere, but...
And England was not the same England.
Evidently. And nobody respected him as a philosopher.
For him it was a real sad...
Nobody respected him, and he had to be made. He must have taught somewhere.
I think he was...
London somewhere, no?
He had been to Cambridge. I think he's right.
That could be, but he may have, yes.
He lived near Cambridge.
That's right. I remember. He must have gone to serve, done a bit of teaching on the side.
Cambridge. He was very unhappy.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's a sad story.
Obviously.
So I thought the same. But, yes.
You wrote on Camus.
And it's a picture for the university, because he was a good teacher. I mean,
he was a perfectly... He was second rate, but he was perfectly well, good, solid disciplinarian and schoolmaster. And why not? Why not?
And
for a place like Jerusalem.
He was a really product of Oxford.
That's quite.
He taught mainly Greek philosophers.
Of course.
And then law.
Yes, yes. Ethics.
I'm not sure how up to date he was in 20th century.
Not very.
I think he didn't take interest in logic.
In his day, modern philosophy, as is now, was not well thought of in Oxford. He belonged to a pre-1914 English tradition. But it was a better tradition than the German tradition, which was a little bit too overladen.
Still, Oxford and Cambridge are still unique. I don't know of any other university, even in the States, that really treat the study of philosophy the way
Harvard does.
Harvard does.
Yes. So does Princeton. So does Berkeley. And lots of other universities.
And
in America, they do.
They really do.
20 universities do, out of many years. Absolutely. So when philosophers go to America, when Americans come here, it's complete, no freak. I mean, they know where they are. They feel totally at home. Totally. For that reason. The discipline is the same discipline. Absolute. The enemies are the same enemies. French philosophers, Italian philosophers, German philosophers have no idea what's going on. No contact.
I think that the French are the most isolated.
We're Italians. Well, French philosophers, of course, are influenced by Heidegger.
By Germans,
certainly.
Sartre couldn't read English.
I don't doubt it.
I know.
He doesn't, I think.
He did read English.
Exactly. Certainly. He was Alsatian, after all. And his name was Schweitzer. He was a great nephew of Albert Schweitzer.
I mean, I was taken aback. That is not a word.
Quite.
You see, the author of the day was going to Germany after he was teaching. I mean, Ramon Aron
went to Germany.
Went to Germany, and then
yes.
he taught philosophy in a high school. He replaced Sartre when Sartre went to Germany.
I understand.
Ramon Aron knew English well.
Very well. But not philosophy. But he didn't know philosophy.
Perfectly,
he didn't do.
He and Maurice Schumann also spoke
perfect. He didn't do philosophy. Ramon Aron.
He didn't do?
No. He wrote a book on philosophy of history. But that's about all. Then he got from Germany.
From
entirely.
I thought he was presently like a legate or something.
Well, maybe, but the formation was German. Yankelevich was also German formed, despite his Russian origin. Well, it was Bergson, up to a point.
But was there any, Ramon Aron became sociologist?
He was called a sociologist. Yeah. He was really politics.
Politics.
He was a high-grade publicist. He was not a great thinker.
But he was very brilliant.
Very?
I mean, the
expose. Marvelous. Extremely clever man. Extremely clever man. Extremely clever man. Tradition of Tocqueville. In the tradition of Tocqueville.
But when you come to philosophy in France, it's always the German. No. Until the Second World War.
No, it began in the 17th century after all.
No.
In the 19th. Bergson was not a disciple of the Germans.
No.
I don't know whom you read.
No, I'm speaking about the generation of Sartre and Ramon Aron. Those who studied in the 20th century.
Yes, they were German. That is correct. England, America and England didn't exist. William James meant nothing to them. William James meant nothing to them. Exactly.
And to this day, I believe that they are very late. I'm not.
Now it's half and half. There are positivists in France. Not many, but they exist. But let me tell you, you're quite right. There was an attempt made by an ex-Jesuit called Leslie Beck, who was a Catholic, brought up in Sorbonne, to try and organize a meeting of French and English philosophers in a place called Royaumont, where there was a famous intellectual center. They came. The gulf widened. Instead of being bridged, it became much wider. They hated. After Merleau-Ponty appeared with photographers, Ryle couldn't bear it and began saying, the Continentals think this and that, the Continentals. With no contact with our Frédéric was there, people who spoke French, some things he spoke French quite well, no contact. Not the same subject.
And in other fields?
There are bridges. There is my friend Montefiore in Balliol, who knows French extremely well, and a great friend of the French philosophers. Freddy knows perfect French. His father was Swiss. Perfect French, he's lectured in Paris. But he was all right then, and he was quite regarded as brilliant and so on. But he had no real contact with any French philosopher now. No friends. No friends. Oh, yes. No friends.
I mean, they didn't exist. I mean, in your days, in the 40s, 50s, there were no philosophers.
In the English sense, then. In the English sense.
Yes, in the English.
No.
Well, in the West, yes. In the English sense.
The only one was Merleau-Ponty had a certain influence on phenomenology. Was not entirely unknown. Husserl. Freddy had nothing to do with it.
Is
Nothing to do with it, nothing to do with it.
No?
Nothing. Friedrich was a narrow, devoted, logical positivist. He may have met these people, but he had no business with them.
He was logical positivist,
I know. But he remained one.
I know.
And they were not. And the result was that, you know, not much intellectual contact.
Have you ever heard this question?